Okay, as I was saying, when my sister and I got to be of age that we should be involved in Sunday school, my mother, I am certain, made the decision that we would go to the Presbyterian church because they had a very strong youth movement and they had a very progressive, well-trained minister and his wife, and they had good Sunday school and other programs for youth. Now, I am sure that there must have been some very serious moments in our household. I was too young to know. But my dad, strong Baptist, lifetime Baptist, superintendent of Sunday school, with his children going to the down the block to the Presbyterian church. I don't know how my mother pulled that off. But that's something that after I got old and I looked at it, I did go to his Sunday school from time to time. But I was a guest there. I was not not a member. But I think that shows you some of the kind of independence and stance that my mother would be inclined to take. It was true that the Baptist church was one where there were generally always problems with factions, one faction supporting the minister and another faction anti and all of that. And so I think she was able to argue from that position that their factions were not good in the church. So, but to me, that was a significant thing in our family life. You were about to ask another question or something?
Oh, yeah, I was just thinking about the neighborhood life. I'm kind of interested in relationships. Do you remember relationships that your family have with neighbors? Do you have an active community? Was it close? Was it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I tell you my father was community-oriented. Not only had he been involved with and stayed involved with the NAACP, but he was very much involved with getting people registered to vote, which was a definite no-no for a school teacher. He was with the various church groups, but he also provided leadership for what was then the American Legion. And the American Legion at that time was needed for blacks because blacks were not getting the benefits and whatever benefits that should have come to veterans. Many of them were just too lacked the knowledge to know what they were entitled to. And so our house was one that I remember veterans coming in and out as though my dad had a law office, but what he was doing was helping them get pensions when they were entitled to them, getting into the hospital, and other things. He was very early on helping with labor unions, which was a no-no, and he helped with that. So he was pretty well known in the community because of his interest and involvement. My mother certainly was with the PTA. She was a teacher with the school. She was with the PTA, but she worked with the church groups. And then later in life, was a very strong member of the Garden Club, which was a sort of a social group that did other things. So there was considerable community involvement, and there were lots of family friends. My father was a scout leader and did a lot to get boys involved with scouting programs and so on.
Now, the American Legion, was there a separate American Legion?
Oh, yeah. Everything was separate. There was nothing that both whites and blacks belonged to at that time together. You were either a subordinate group, you know. I forget. In fact, there's some kind of title that the American Legion had at that time, which was really the black unit. It was sort of like Unit B of the American Legion, something like that. But no, they were not together. there were paid, each community had a paid service person, sort of like a social worker or whatever, to service veterans. And he was available to them, but he was very glad that Dad took a lot of the things that needed to be done. And this was another, I think Dr. Butterfield was active with that too. But if you ask about community life there, there were a lot of things, mostly done through the churches for youth and for socialization of people. And I guess the church was the main means for socialization of people in our community.
You mentioned your dad was active in labor unions. Do you remember the type of labor organizing that?
Yeah. I guess it was some offshoot of AFL-CIO, but it was tobacco workers. And most of the organizers came out of this area, Durham. But they would get into a community and would need to be able to reach the workers. And people like my dad, who knew most of the people around town, were able to help them make the contacts and keep from being run out of town, because they would run them out of town too. The factory people didn't want the unions organized and didn't want them to belong to unions. Now, much of this came about in the 40s. Okay. The unions, the union work. In 38 and 39, there was a female professor at Central who did much in terms of going out in the community. She wasn't a sociologist person, she was a biology teacher. A Dr. Young, I don't know if you may want to seek some information on a Dr. Young. Can't remember her first name, but there would be records of her. As in addition to her work as a teacher, she did a lot to go in eastern North Carolina to try to get the tobacco workers organized so that they could benefit from what the unions do.
Do you recall, and I'm thinking here about entertainers, people like Marian Anderson, Paul Robeson. Mm-hmm. Do you recall any of those figures?
Yeah. All of us knew them. We knew them from the radio. Mm-hmm. You know, like the kids, they know everybody from TV. But we knew them, if they got national attention like that, we knew them from the radio. And there were occasions when they would get them down to a city like Raleigh or somewhere else, and the people would come from distances to hear them. Now, in the college days, for the Lyceum programs, you got them. The colleges got people of that stature to come for our Lyceum programs. And that was beneficial. We were even the orators, we got all of those. And someone mentioned to me just recently when Sam Proctor spoke at the installation of Chambers as chancellor at NC Central. And he looked around and he didn't see many students there. And he said, this is regrettable, because Sam Proctor is perhaps one of the last noted black artists as such, Mordecai Johnson, Howard Thurman, that order. But we were exposed to them. And from time to time, the small towns would somehow arrange to get them to make appearances in their communities. But they were our heroes.
And I mention them because there are two interesting events that happened in the late 30s, Marian Anderson's concert at the Lincoln Memorial, Robeson becoming the first person to do an entire public performance of Black spirituals.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very interested in
mm-hmm. Well, we go even further back than that. I was trying to remember, I guess, one of the first to really get attention on Broadway, I can't think of his name, did the dramatization of The Creation. What am I, do you know that? But doesn't come to me now. Maybe it will in the course of a conversation. But that was one of the things that the black teachers did try to make us aware of, people who were achieving. And some of my colleagues at Central and around didn't believe that I had a course in Negro history in 1934. In a public school. And it was the initiative of this teacher who had the interest and the principal who approved it. And we had a course in Negro history, but most homes had books about that. Carter G. Woodson's Negro history, they had Paul Lynch Dunbar's poems and some cultural things that they attempted to provide.
There was a visit by Walter White.
Walter White, yeah.
Did you remember that?
I thought he, I remember him visiting Wilson and the whole region. Yeah. I don't remember exactly when, but was it the matter of investigating an incident? Is that what you're referring to, or coming as a speaker or as a promoter?
I think he more coming as a speaker.
Mm-hmm. I guess he was coming as a speaker and promoting the NAACP and promoting community organization for the cause. You see, by the time Walter White had been on the scene, I think it was even after that that we were beginning to get suits for school equalization. They were not school suits for integration or anything. They were suits to improve Negro schools.
And there was a suit filed in Wilson? Or was
there may have been. By that time, I was away. I'm pretty sure that they must have filed a suit in Wilson because they filed them all over in 48, 49, 50. That was the thing to do, to file those equalization suits, because the court was enforcing the requirement that schools should be equal. And so you had to get on the scene and you file suits. That was 48, 49. My growing up days did not have to do with equalization schools, but getting the county to provide schools for public education. And the things of great interest were that of getting equalization of teachers' pay. That was a big issue in 36, 35, and further to get equalization of pay for teachers, because the pay discrepancies were clear. There was nothing to be ashamed of insofar as the powers to be were concerned.
Mm-hmm. And were your parents involved in that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the selling of crisis. What other types of information? Well, in other words, were there any other types of newspapers that were particular to the black community?
Mm-hmm. The paper that was most popular, would you like one of these? Was most popular in our community was the Norfolk Journal and Guide. That was a paper out of Norfolk, as the title implies. It was the Norfolk Journal and Guide. Then there was the Pittsburgh Courier, which was a relatively popular paper. the Afro-American, is that the name of the paper, out of Baltimore, yeah. Those were the papers that were pretty well subscribed to. And lots of my friends saw those papers. And those were the means for to keep up with what was happening to the Negro population.
A lot of things were happening in the late 1930s. I know going through some of the Pittsburgh Courier articles, mm-hmm. a lot of really exciting things that were happening in Chicago. Now, did any of that, reading those papers, did that affect the community in Wilson?
No doubt it must have had some positive influence on the aspirations of people there and may have been incentives for actions on the part of people in the community. I don't know of any one incident, but you see, those were lynching times. And we were pushing to get anti-lynching legislation, to get other federal things. We couldn't get them statewide. They were also pushing for the elimination of the poll tax. As I recall, those were big issues during my teen and early years. And just the right to vote. And the elimination of required quoting the Constitution, all of those kinds of problems. And that, there again is where my dad took chances, because he would take people to get them registered. And that was something that was frowned upon.
Were there black people that voted before then?
Yeah. They permitted a few black people who asserted themselves and who did show some degree of literacy, a high level of literacy for that matter, because they required all kinds of things. But there had to be the effort to get others who were not literate to want to register and vote. And sometimes it was a fearful thing to go before a registrar whose property you lived on, who had some power or influence over your existence. So those were problems that I was able to get some notion of, but not experiencing it myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that Judge Butterfield mentioned was that when his father came to town, he was actually asked by some of the white citizens who wanted to register to vote. But it was more of maybe co-opting. In other words, if he agreed to vote for the right candidates,
yeah.
He could register. Do you remember that?
No, I find it believable and all, because the matter of blacks being registered was decisions that whites held, and it was not a right that you could demand, though you may have attempted to demand. And it took some doing.
So you leave Wilson, you graduate, then you leave in 1937?
37.
And then where do you go from there?
Where did I go to school or what?
Yeah.
Okay. When I graduated from high school, I guess I was 15 and about to become 16. We had 11 grades then, and I'd gotten off to an early start in school. I wasn't that adept a student. I'd gotten an early start and continued. And and so my hopes were to go to a Presbyterian college, Smith. That's where my other friends from my high school were going. And I guess my mother, rightfully so, recognized that I was quite an immature kid. And perhaps going right into a college was not the thing for me. So she sent me to a junior college. And I guess you've heard of the name Charlotte Hawkins Brown in terms of study. She established a preparatory school up at Sedalia. It was a high school, and eventually she added the two-year college part. And I went there, saw it as a buffer to going to a college where I would have more freedom and exposure to all kinds of people. And it was a very interesting experience, and we could talk a long time about that, and you may want to talk to someone about Palmer Memorial Institute, Sedalia. A lot of the people from here who live here sent their children to Palmer Memorial Institute, and her effort was to develop students culturally. We had to learn which knife or which eating instrument to use at what time, how to sit, to hold on chairs for the ladies, to do all of the kinds of nice things that I didn't think was overdoing it, but I think were important in terms of cultural development and being able to function in a variety of settings. But it's for this history that you're doing, I do think that some attention should be given to what that school was like. There are a number of people here who can tell you, if you want to take Margaret Goodwin, that's Bill Kennedy's sister. And Bill Kennedy went there himself, the recent retired president of North Carolina Mutual. Dr. Watts's wife, Constance Watts. Mickey Mashaw. Those are some people who could tell you about Sedalia. And I think my mother wanted some of that for me, as well as recognizing that I was not really ready for a four-year institution with people a bit older than myself. So I went there the first year, and it was a very beneficial experience. And then the next 3 years, I went to school at NC Central. So that those were the college days.
What was NC Central like back in
1938? NC Central was, in 1938, Jim Shepherd's school. Jim Shepherd was the founder, the president, and really the board of trustees, if you wish, whatever. It was his school. And he had, at that time, there must have been 400 or so students. And I'm told that his thought was that he'd like to keep it at about 500. Well, I can understand that in the sense that he wanted to manage everything and to manage it. There were good teachers, people who had been well prepared in universities all over, including some European universities. Most of the people there were there for teacher education. If they weren't there for teacher education, they were there for medicine or something. When I came out of high school, if you talk to a male in the South, in this region, in terms of our exposure, a black male, in terms of our exposure, you had only two careers. One was teaching, the other was medicine, and those were the careers. Now, true enough, there was preparation in agriculture at A&T, and rural kids knew about that, that you could go there and learn to become an agricultural extension agent or a home agent or something. The relatively new was the library science offering at NC Central, and so that was new. And then the business department. That was something that black kids in high schools had not been exposed to very much in terms of what was business, and they were just beginning to add typing courses to the high school curriculum and things like that. But before that time, when I came out, there was not a typing course offered anywhere or anything related to that. So the options were limited. We had a goodly number who did get out and get into medical school, and others who got other exposures once they got out of college. But one of the noteworthy things about NC Central was that the state supported it as a liberal arts institution, and they were willing to support teacher training institutions, and then the A&T was land grant, that's federal for agricultural extension, but the state supporting a liberal arts college was something within itself. All the students, for the most part, lived on the campus in dormitories. They had very strict requirements about what time you were in the dormitory for the females, and you ate as a family group in the dining room. They didn't have cafeterias. There were intercollegiate athletics, which was a strong aspect of the program. There were efforts to provide cultural experiences, and I mentioned about the speakers we had. There had to be a Vesper program every Sunday, which had its religious focus. And those are some of the things that I recall about it.
Did you, what was it like moving from Wilson to Durham? Did you find yourself doing different things, learning different things in terms of being in a new town?
Well, when I came to Durham to go to college, most of college life was campus focused. The campus, I would suspect that of the students who were in my generation coming to Durham, where the largest, which they'd studied about and which had been told about all over the country, the largest Negro-owned business in the world was here, North Carolina Mutual. I'd be willing to gamble that out of our students at that time, that 60% of them didn't know where the North Carolina Mutual's headquarters was located. That there was just that much. They knew Mr. Spaulding because Dr. Shepherd would have C.C. Spaulding down to speak at our programs. Maybe some of the other officials. They didn't do any banking. The kids, they didn't have any banking. I mean, we had no bank accounts, so they didn't know anything about the black banks. They understood that there was some black banks somewhere around. But to know about Durham, there wasn't a lot that the students learned unless some of them worked at Duke Hospital as they did, as orderlies or something. Those were males. The females didn't do anything off campus. So I guess the exposure to the big town for black students, and most of us were from rural North Carolina and rural eastern North Carolina, was when we would come down here on Main Street to shop. That was our exposure, to ride the bus down the Main Street and go to the Carolina Theater or the Center Theater and sit up in the balcony. That was about the exposure. Again, 60% of them probably never set foot on Duke's campus during their 4 years here. And they may have heard some noted professor of Duke speak on the campus, someone from the School of Theology. They knew how to get to the bus station and to the train station. So where you saw the contrast in the towns was when you went to the shopping center or the other things like that. I doubt if they knew Well, I know I didn't know much or anything about the political activities in Durham at that time, and very little about what social life was like among blacks.
Now you received your degree in 1941. Mm-hmm. And where do you go from there?
Okay. In 1941, you see, the war in Europe had begun, right? 38, 39, things were very bad. But when I came in 1941, the draft was in place. They were already drafting people for military service. And I had a teaching certificate, but I knew that I was going into the Army, and I didn't particularly have much enthusiasm for teaching. And nevertheless, my father got me a job teaching right away. That summer when I got out, I went to work in Fayetteville at a USO. Fort Bragg was growing and growing and growing. And so I worked at a USO that summer. And by the end of the summer, my father called me that I had a job, and they made me principal of a four teacher school, which meant I taught and kept the records and all. And I was very high on the draft list. I made it through to the fall of 1942, and that's when I was drafted into the Army, and I did 3 years of military service, North Africa, Europe, and Philippines. It was my first exposure of really traveling anywhere. I guess the extent of my travel through those years had been to Washington and Baltimore, and I don't think I'd even been to Atlanta that time. I traveled in North Carolina, but I got an opportunity to travel. I went directly to the West Coast for military training, and I got to see North Africa and Europe.
What was that like, traveling and going to North Africa?
Well, one of the things that you would know was that this was my first experience of not being in a segregated society, going to California and being able to go on a pass and not having to worry about, well, not being as conscious of whether or not this was a place that blacks could go. I couldn't go. Whereas all the years here, I knew where I couldn't go, and knew what I couldn't do, and where I could sit on the bus, and all of that. Well, that was quite a very impressionable experience to be able to sit where I wanted to sit on a bus, and to not have anybody look at me strangely if I got into what might have been an out-of-place position or activity or something. And so it was an enlightening experience to be in California. To go to a lunch counter in Los Angeles and order my lunch or sandwich or something, and the waiter would tell me that the gentleman down on that end of the counter had paid for it. Well, I don't know whether he was doing it just because I was black or because that was what they were doing for soldiers then. So it was part of it, but that's something, an experience I would not have had here. So that's part of what you're asking me, I guess, in response to what you asked me. We were still in segregated units, and we had white officers, and but all black soldiers. There were lots of. That was my first time to to really be exposed in terms of being intermingled with a large, very large group of illiterate persons. I'd come up in the neighborhood where I grew up in Wilson. You just went to school. It was automatic. Poor or what, you went to school. And the truant officer didn't have to do very much to keep you in school. And so most of the people I knew how to read and write and do all those things. But when I was drafted and taken to Fort Bragg and then put on a troop train to California, I was with 500-600 men or more. And out of that number, I doubt that there were more than 40 who could really read the sheet of paper that you have there. They'd come off the farms, the rural places in South Carolina, Alabama, et cetera. And that was a traumatic experience for me to be on the troop train where you're very closely tied in. You are the fella I shared the bunk with, had gonorrhea. And I didn't really know what gonorrhea was, but he sort of let me know that he was having this problem, and I discerned it was gonorrhea. All up and down the land in our car, they were shooting dice. So that was a new exposure to me. The fellas in college gamble, but they, the little gambling they did, they played poker or something. I don't ever remember seeing them gamble rolling dice. And there were knives. They were threatening each other with knives. They were looking for opportunities to buy alcohol. And it was quite an experience.
Was there a lot of, I mean, did some of it revolve around race relations?
These are all blacks now.
Okay, these are all
blacks. This is all black, a black group. But a black group so handicapped in the sense of not having just pure literacy. My first job in the Army was to teach fellas how to sign the payroll. They had to sign the payroll to be paid. And the Army wasn't supposed to be taking in people who did X's, but that was all most of them had done before that time, was put an X. And the person took care of. But now, so my first job was to teach them how to sign the payroll. And that was a real exposure to disastrous effects of rural black-white relationships, and that there was no effort to see that most of these kids had been received education. Most of them were strong and muscular because they worked. They worked on farms, they worked in the lumber mills, they worked everywhere. That was what they were brought up to do, and that was about the height of their aspiration. But after exposure to fellows who were threatening to cut each other every moment and who were finding the joy in getting a drink or being able to get to a prostitute and so on, I got to know them a little better, and it was admirable that some of the values and attitudes that many of those fellows had, irrespective of their upbringing and their exposure. And I found some gratification in things. For example, there's one fellow whom I still remember. His name was Super. He was from somewhere in South Carolina. Super couldn't read a bit, but he learned to sign his name. But when we would go, we were in French-speaking countries. We were in Italy, where they spoke Italian. And so we didn't have that much doing in Germany. But Frank Suber learned to communicate with people in the settings where we were camped faster than the officers did. Yeah, he just somehow had a knack for learning to communicate. And it was amazing. what some of those fellows could do with such limitations. They also had a kind of attitudes towards whites. Whites were boss. You know, they looked at them as boss men. That's what they had been. They'd owned the farms where they worked. They'd owned the lumber mills where they worked. And the sheriff had been on them and so on. And they saw whites as boss men. And if at the point where they were willing to disagree or rebel, it meant total rebellion. It wasn't a matter of saying arguing for a point or getting a position on a point. It meant when they, as best I perceived it, when they got to be anti what the white man said, that meant they were ready to go all the way. They were ready to kill, if need be. And I guess this is what some of the experiences have been in those areas, that when they bucked, so to speak, the white man, that they knew that they were possibly going to be lynched, going to be put in jail and beaten to death, or what have you. So when you make your move, you make an all-out effort. That kind of exposure I had not known in Wilson and in Durham and so on. And that kind of mindset, and it was really something. I guess I should have made notes on some of the kinds of amazing things that I learned with these groups of fellows. Many of them were very religious, and could be led that way. Okay, well, that's that you asked me about my leaving this area, going to other areas, and those are thoughts that came along as I traveled. We had, for example, the commander of our unit was a white man, was a major from over here, Mebane, and he came from a family that does furniture, white furniture company. He told all of his officers, and all of his officers were at that time white officers, that they had to keep the Negroes, and that's what he called them, the Negroes, that they had to keep the Negroes busy, and that the Negro would do anything a white man told him to do, if he told him forcefully. And to some extent, for some of those fellows, that was right. He knew what he was talking about. And it very much bothered a young officer, young Captain Williams, I remember very much. It very much bothered him. He'd come through VMI or some military school, and he had all the principles about how you discipline and how you train. And here his superior was telling him just to order people around and don't try to do anything. And in fact, I guess this gives you an idea. I was a corporal and then a sergeant. And he wanted me to become a platoon leader, non-commissioned platoon leader. And I told him that I couldn't be a platoon leader because I was not forceful enough. The fellow who preceded me was very forceful, and they respected what Sergeant Rollins told them to do and so on. And he just commanded everything. And so here Captain Williams was asking me to move into that position. And I told him I had no aspirations to do that, that I would want to get some other things that were available to us at that time, but not that. And he, and different from what the major, the commanding officer was, he was saying that that's not leadership, being able to command and use forcefulness. That leadership is when people will do things because they have a particular attitude with respect to your leadership, to your commands, and to your requests and so on of them. And I had not at that time had any community or courses or any courses on that. But it impressed me that this young officer was trying to use the things that he'd really learned in theory and so on, in contrast to what the Southern white colonel, as he'd become then, was telling him to do. But that shows you something of white-black relationships. We went to California, said we were out at San Bernardino. The first thing that this colonel from the South, from Mebane, North Carolina, said to us as a troop, he gathered his whole battalion together. And he, in so many words, said, you black fellas, you can do certain things here in San Bernardino, as it was called, that there are things here that places you can go and so on, but you know your place. In so many words, that's what he said. You know your place. Don't get out of place. Don't get out of line. And that was quite something. He took all the whole battalion together and said, even though you're in California, you can remember where you came from and what you did or had to do where you came from. And that was a difference.
So you think he was trying to kind of recreate the order of the South?
Yeah, the South. That was what he was trying to do. As my understanding, he went so far as to try to get the officials of San Bernardino to try to establish such procedures.
Jim Crow?
Right, for his troops. There weren't that many blacks in San Bernardino anyway, as residents. And here we got a whole host of them there coming in.
What kind of unit was it?
It was a labor company. It was a quartermaster labor. In other words, these were the persons who were to load the trucks, move things, do labor, physical labor. It was a quartermaster labor company.